Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Cheese and the Worms, The Cosmos of a 16th Century Miller by Carlo Ginzburg. Translated by Ann C. Tedeschi and John Tedeschi. Narrated by P.J. Oakland. Tout ce qui est intéressant se passe dans l'ombre. On ne sait rien de la véritable histoire des hommes. Céline. Preface to the 2013 edition. This book was first published in 1976 in Italian. I had come across the name of Domenico Scandella in the early 1960s by mere chance, or nearly so. At the time, I was interested in trials against witches and benandanti, persons who fought in spirit against witches, in the northeastern corner of Italy, the Friuli, in the 16th and 17th centuries. They would become the subject of my first book. While leafing through a manuscript index, compiled by an 18th century inquisitor, of the first 1,000 trials held by the Holy Office of Aquileia and Concordia, I ran into a brief resume, no more than a few lines, of a trial against a peasant accused of saying that the world had been created from putrefaction. I copied the call numbers of the 2 trials against him on a scrap of paper, and promised myself that one day I would return to Udine to look them up. Now and then I would recall that notation. 7 years passed. In 1970, I decided to order a microfilm of the 2 trials. I began reading and was instantly struck by them. I transcribed the texts and commenced studying them. Almost 7 years later, I published Il formaggio e I vermi, The Cheese and the Worms. People who have read the work in one of the many languages into which it has been translated over the years, quite properly did not concern themselves overly much about its author. More engrossing was the story that it told, and the miller who was its protagonist. I, too, today could limit myself to citing the studies that over the years have added to and corrected what we know about Menocchio. I have no intention of recapitulating the history of the reception of my book, a matter with which I am not really familiar. I would rather say something about the context from which the book emerged. For many years, I have been reflecting on the discrepancy between the intentions of the writer, or the agent, and the results of what gets written, or produced. I shall start from the relationship between contiguity and distance, between the person I am today and the person I was then. I began to learn how to be a historian toward the end of the 1950s by trying to salvage from inquisitorial trials the fragments of a persecuted, obliterated, forgotten peasant culture. This choice, influenced by Antonio Gramsci's prison reflections on the culture of the subaltern classes, preceded my casual and indirect contact with Menocchio's trials. Yet it does not explain my decision to occupy myself with them, which I undertook many years later. In the attention I gave to the echo of Menocchio's words, the words which would provide the book with its title, though they were rendered banal by the inquisitors, I recognize in hindsight the same impulse that had led me in my first book to study the Friulian Benandanti. Menocchio's testimony represented an intriguing aberration in respect to a theme, witchcraft, which was itself quite exceptional in respect to mainstream historiography. The present book also was born out of a passion for the anomalous, and from meditating on the connection between anomaly and the norm. In the early 1970s, François Furet wrote that what we know about the non-privileged classes is necessarily statistical, a statement which, ipso facto, disqualified as irrelevant research such as mine. I, instead of doing research on the privileged classes, had embarked on the study of a miller who had a name, who had strange ideas, and who had read a number of books. The substance of a possible footnote had become the subject of a book. The persecuted and the vanquished, whom many historians dismissed as marginal and usually altogether ignored, were here the focus of the research. It was a choice I had made much earlier, but which drew new energy and justification from the radical political climate of the 1970s. And yet, this decision ran up against a major obstacle. The voices of the persecuted reach us, when they do, through the filters of their persecutors' questions, and as copied down by third parties, the notaries. This was the case even with Menocchio, with the exception of the letter to his son. What value can be attributed to documents, such as the transcripts of inquisitorial trials, that are the product of pressure, psychological, cultural, and physical? I had run into this difficulty even with my first book, I Benandanti. It was documents, the trial documents, which compelled me to a reflection on the historian's role, a concern I have carried on in various guises to this day. In the case of the Benandanti, I thought I could get around the obstacle thanks to the discrepancy between the questions of the inquisitors and the responses of the defendants. For the former, the tales of the Benandanti about their nocturnal battles, fought in spirit against witches and warlocks, were a mass of absurdities. Menocchio's judges greeted his explanations about the origin of the world with the same disbelief. In both cases, the gap separating the interrogations by the judges from the responses of the defendants excluded the possibility that the first could have influenced the second. But another element emerged from the examination of Menocchio's trials. The disparity between how Menocchio remembered the books he had read and the actual books themselves. A deep stratum of oral culture emerged from that very discrepancy. The filter unconsciously employed by Menocchio when he approached the printed page. "What is most profound in history may also be the most certain," wrote Mark Bloch. I had always thought that this statement presupposed Freud. But today, I would be tempted to interpret it through another analogy. The relative inability of the actors, inquisitors, Menocchio, to process our queries summons up a situation comparable to so-called double-blind experiments, the purposes of which are not known either to the experimenter or the subjects of the experiment. An experiment always takes place under specific conditions, but its results, with the necessary precautions, can have broader implications. The Dutch sociologist Tony Hawk, for example, began from the Menocchio case and went on to construct a model of exegesis that was applicable to the most diverse texts, including the clinical charts of patients in psychiatric institutions. Later on, I shall refer to other generalizations that were inspired even by the highly unusual case of Menocchio. It seems clear, nonetheless, that case and generalization bring us close to microhistory, of which The Cheese and the Worms has often been considered a typical example, although when it was first published, the term microhistory had not yet entered the historical lexicon. This sort of reading from a microhistorical perspective, which certainly influenced my retrospective understanding of the work, was itself conditioned by the form in which the book had been written. In 1970, I began to teach in Bologna. I quickly found myself involved in discussions connected with the plans for a journal which were never realized. The initiative was led by two writers. Italo Calvino was already well known. The other, Gianni Celati, had just arrived on the literary scene. Much of the talk concerned the term archaeology, which one of the participants, Enzo Melandri, a brilliant philosopher, redefined on the basis of notions advanced by Michel Foucault, which left me quite perplexed. The original preface to The Cheese and the Worms contains a remnant, decisively a polemical one, of those ancient discussions. But the liberating effect which I received from them was not limited to the preface. During a recent interview, the Austrian historian Stefan Steiner pointed out to me that the characteristic need to reveal how a piece of research is constructed, recurring in my writings, is rarely encountered among historians. Steiner sees in this an echo of great 20th century literature. I agreed with him completely, mentioning Proust especially, and then Brecht. But in 1970, when I began working on Minocchio's trials, I added a new name to these, Raymond Queneau, whose Les Fleurs Bleues was about to appear in Italian in Calvino's splendid translation. I was tempted to imitate Queneau's Exercice de Style by organizing the book I was writing, The Cheese and the Worms, as a sequence of paragraphs written in different styles and taking inspiration from various genres, including historiographical parody. I abandoned this idea almost at once because its frivolity contrasted too strongly with the nature of the documents. Nevertheless, it left some traces in the construction of the book, especially in the alternation of documentary fragments offered without comment in the pursuit of hypotheses, later abandoned, and so forth. To put in evidence how research is constructed had and still has more than formal implications. The liveliness of the oral exchanges transmitted to us by the inquisitorial trials is both real and illusory. We seem to know Minocchio, but he also eludes us, and not just because his responses were made under pressure, even before torture was applied. Access to the past is always mediated, and thus always partial. Since it is always mediated, always tied to a point of view, historical knowledge is by definition perfectible, even when, as can happen, human error does not intrude. All this occurred, as expected, also with this book. Minocchio's trial records, which I had cited at length but in a fragmentary way, have been critically and admirably edited in their entirety by Andrea Del Col. The work contains a long introduction, which on a number of points left me perplexed. In his retelling of the story, Del Col added new elements taken from documents previously unknown to me. It emerges from this fresh material how a number of witnesses had testified that the priest of Monte Reale, Odorico Vorai, had made advances to Minocchio's daughters. When confronted, the cleric had, in turn, denounced Minocchio to the Inquisition. At the conclusion of the first trial, a number of Minocchio's friends and relatives plotted their revenge. They assaulted the priest, who barely managed to escape. Not long after, Vorai left Monte Reale and settled in a nearby village, where he took charge of a parish created especially for him. Del Col fleshed out my reconstruction of events in a number of particulars, pointing out an error in my account. The two letters dated 30 August and 13 November 1599, written by Cardinal Santa Severina of the Supreme Roman Congregation of the Inquisition, are not about Minocchio, as I had surmised, but about another Friulian heretic, Antonio Scodelaro. By those dates, Minocchio had already been executed. In a notarial document dated 16 August, turned up by Del Col, Stefano Scandella is referred to as the son of the deceased Domenico Scandella. This supplementary information and these corrections undoubtedly add to what we know. I am not convinced, however, by Del Col's suggestion that Minocchio's ideas stemmed from the Cathar heresy. It is a hypothesis which I too had contemplated at the beginning of my research on these documents, but which I subsequently tacitly abandoned. Del Col takes up the idea independently, but suggests many attenuating circumstances which almost seem to cancel it out. The Friulian miller certainly is no Cathar, nor is his religion, as it is documented in the trials, entirely based on Cathar concepts. Minocchio is not a Cathar. Del Col clearly saw that his hypothesis postulated a transmission of ideas over centuries, which could not be otherwise documented. Actually, I myself had set an example by formulating an even more daring hypothesis based on pure conjecture, namely on the presumed parallels between the theories of Minocchio about the chaos from which angels were born, which he compared to worms issuing from cheese, and the cosmogonies diffused in Central Asia. In a sharp but generous review, The anthropologist Valerio Valeri had praised my book while demolishing my conjectures, which he attributed to populist fanaticism, a romantic idea of the collective, spontaneous, and immemorial nature of popular tradition. I have often spoken elsewhere about the connections between populism, to some extent tied to the surroundings in which I grew up, and the choices I made as a historian. It is an impulse which led me to some errors and exaggerations. I do not want to defend the former. The latter are, I think, an ingredient of the manner in which the acquisition of knowledge arrives one burst at a time. Unless I am mistaken, none of my critics have questioned my analysis of the mechanics of Minocchio's readings, to which I dedicated the greater part of the book. But even this analysis came from a populist option, namely that it was proper to try to reconstruct the Miller's actual books and the way he had read them. Such a choice seems obvious today, but it was not at the time. Books and essays have been devoted to some of these writings, in part prompted by my own book. The Cheese and the Worms has enjoyed great success and has been translated into many languages. It has been read in ways which are often beyond me, through cultural as well as linguistic filters which are inaccessible to me. It can happen. Why did it happen? I think we need to look for the answer, first of all, in the extraordinary protagonist of the story, Domenico Scandella, called Minocchio. But even an exceptional person lives and acts in a context, or better, several contexts. Two elements appear in the Minocchio saga, which render it instantly comprehensible even for those of us who live in a time far removed from his. The interweaving between oral and written culture, and his challenge to authority, both political and religious. The name of this unknown Miller is remembered today because of the challenge he lost. Once again, I am deeply grateful to my translators, John and Dan Tedeschi, for their unfailing competence, their generosity, and their friendship. Translator's Note: We take great pleasure in presenting an English translation, Carlo Ginzburg's Il Formaggio e I Vermi, a lively and ingenious attempt to reconstruct the intellectual world of a 16th century miller who lived out his days in a remote Friulian village. The book has been rightly hailed as one of the most significant recent contributions to a burgeoning field of study, the popular culture of early modern Europe. We are hopeful that the present endeavor will help to draw attention to the need of making other distinguished Italian works of history available to a larger public through translation. The Cheese and the Worms differs slightly from the original Einaudi edition published in 1976. New are a second preface especially written for this version, the insertion of a date, and a reply to a critic. No systematic attempt has been made to bring the references up to date. However, the appearance of recent contributions by Elizabeth Eisenstein, Emmanuel Leroy-Ladurie, and a handful of others could not be ignored and have been noted at appropriate points in the book. English titles of works in other languages used by the author have been supplied whenever they were known to us. On the organization and procedures of the Roman Holy Office, the institution whose insistence on a full recording of all events transpiring before its tribunal made the present study possible, there is unfortunately no modern comprehensive study available in any language. A few observations, however, are in order. The Roman Inquisition, founded in 1542 by Pope Paul III as a direct response to the Protestant challenge in Italy, should not be confused with the Inquisition in Spain or other areas of Europe, nor with the Inquisition of the Middle Ages, which was the subject of Henry Charles Lee's history. The Inquisition, far from being a monolithic structure, was an institution that experienced development and change in terms of organization, procedures, and definitions of the law throughout its long history. The two stages, medieval and modern, must not be understood as a single phenomenon. Furthermore, While moral justice was impossible in a context where the Catholic Church felt, together with virtually all other secular and religious authorities on both sides of the Alps, that it had the right, even the duty, to persecute those who differed in their religious beliefs. Legal justice in 16th-century terms was dispensed by the Roman Inquisition. It was not a drumhead court, a chamber of horrors, or a judicial labyrinth from which escape was impossible. Capricious and arbitrary decisions, misuse of authority, and wanton abuse of human rights were not tolerated. Rome watched over the provincial tribunals, enforced the observance of what was, for the times, an essentially moderate code of law, and maintained, to the extent that a consensus existed, uniformity of practice. A word of explanation should be given on the subject of inquisitorial record-keeping. A permanent and indispensable member of every inquisitorial court was the notary, or a cleric deputized to assume this function, who transcribed in writing as the legal manuals required, not only all the defendant's responses and any statements he might make, but also what he might utter during the torture, even his sighs, his cries, his laments, and tears. Since most trial records were generally reviewed by the Supreme Tribunal in Rome before the pronouncement of sentence, the practice of recording legal proceedings in their entirety was designed to discourage irregularities, including the tendency of some examiners to ask leading or suggestive questions. The notary's charge was to transcribe everything that transpired verbatim. On occasion, however, as portions of the present book indicate, both questions and answers were reported in the third person. The author naturally is obliged to place such passages within quotation marks because they are part of the trial record, even if they are not direct quotes. An example of this occurs in section 20, where a question by the inquisitor is transformed by the notary into an indirect form of discourse. The defendant is exhorted to name all his accomplices, or else more rigorous measures would be taken against him. Further brief introductory remarks on the subject are provided in John Tedeschi, Preliminary Observations on Writing a History of the Roman Inquisition, in Continuity and Discontinuity in Church History. Those wishing to learn more about the productive career of Carlo Ginzburg, the brilliant young scholar who is the author of this book, are invited to refer to the profile by Ann J. Schutte, Carlo Ginzburg, Journal of Modern History, 48. The interested may wish to consult Domenico Scandella detto Menocchio, I Processi dell'Inquisizione, a cura di Andrea del Col. The work includes critical editions of the two trials of Menocchio, together with new archival data, and a long historical introduction that elucidates the organization and procedures of the Inquisition and the Friulian background of the story. An English translation of the volume is scheduled to appear in the series of Medieval and Renaissance Texts and Studies, Binghamton. Our translation benefited greatly from the many constructive criticisms and suggestions received from the author and from the staff and consultants of the Johns Hopkins University Press, especially Henry Y.K. Tom, Mary Lou Kenny, and Eduardo Saccone. Professors Paolo Cherchi of the University of Chicago and Ronnie Turpening of Loyola University Chicago struggled with us patiently over a number of mystifying terms of 16th-century Friulian dialect. Bernard E. Wilson of the Newberry Library read the entire manuscript of the text and left his mark on almost every page. We are extremely grateful to him, as well as to all others named and unnamed whose advice and support helped to bring the cheese and the worms into being. With mixed sentiments of sadness and relief, we take leave of this book and its quixotic protagonist, Menocchio. We feel confident that both will capture the listener's esteem and affection, as they did ours. John Tedeschi, Ann C. Tedeschi. Preface to the English edition. As frequently happens, this research too came about by chance. In 1962, I spent part of the summer in Udine, in the extremely rich and at that time still unexplored deposit of inquisitorial papers preserved in the Archivio della Curia Arcivescovile of that city. I was searching for trials against a strange Friulian sect whose members were identified with witches and witch doctors by the judges. Later, I wrote a book about them. Leafing through one of these manuscript volumes of trials, I came upon an extremely long sentence. One of the accusations against the defendant was that he maintained the world had its origin in putrefaction. This phrase instantly captured my curiosity. But I was looking for other things. Witches, witch doctors, benandanti. I wrote down the number of the trial. In the next few years, that notation periodically leaped out from among my papers and from my memory. In 1970, I resolved to try to understand what that statement could have meant for the person by whom it had been uttered. At that time, what I knew about him was only his name, Domenico Scandella, called Menocchio. This book tells his story. Thanks to an abundant documentation, we are able to learn about his readings and his discussions, his thoughts and his sentiments, fears, hopes, ironies, rages, despairs. Every now and then, the directness of the sources brings him very close to us. A man like ourselves. One of us. But he is also a man very different from us. The analytical reconstruction of this difference was necessary in order to reconstruct the physiognomy, partly obscured, of his culture and of the social context in which it had taken shape. It has been possible to trace Menocchio's complicated relationship with written culture. The books, or more precisely some of the books, that he read, and the manner in which he read them. In this way, there emerged a filter, a grill that Menocchio interposed unconsciously between himself and the texts, whether obscure or illustrious, which came into his hands. This filter, on the other hand, presupposed an oral culture that was the patrimony not only of Menocchio, but also of a vast segment of 16th-century society. Consequently, an investigation initially pivoting on an individual, moreover an apparently unusual one, ended by developing into a general hypothesis on the popular culture, more precisely, peasant culture, of pre-industrial Europe, in the age marked by the spread of printing and the Protestant Reformation, and by the repression of the latter in Catholic countries. This hypothesis can be linked to what has already been proposed in very similar terms by Mikhail Bakhtin, and can be summed up by the term circularity. Between the culture of the dominant classes and that of the subordinate classes, there existed in pre-industrial Europe a circular relationship composed of reciprocal influences, which traveled from low to high, as well as from high to low. The Cheese and the Worms is intended to be a story as well as a piece of historical writing. Thus, it is addressed to the general listener as well as to the specialist. But I hope that both will recognize in this episode an unnoticed but extraordinary fragment of a reality, half obliterated, which implicitly poses a series of questions for our own culture and for us. Preface to the Italian edition. 1. In the past, historians could be accused of wanting to know only about the great deeds of kings. But today, this is certainly no longer true. More and more, they are turning toward what their predecessors passed over in silence, discarded, or simply ignored. Who built Thebes of the Seven Gates? Bertolt Brecht's literate worker was already asking. The sources tell us nothing about these anonymous masons, but the question retains all its significance. 2. The scarcity of evidence about the behavior and attitudes of the subordinate classes of the past is certainly the major, though not the only, obstacle faced by research of this type. But there are exceptions.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?